My name is Ralph White, and I'm an alcoholic. I want to thank the specific group for asking me to come back out again. You know, mouthful of blessings right there. Asking me to come out is a blessing. Asking me to come back out is a blessing. Being able to make it back out is a blessing. I want to thank my good friend Bob picking me up at the airport. You know, I want to again say hello to a lot of old friends I have in this room, and I want to say hello to my new friends. You know, thank you, Denise, for sharing so that I get a meeting. I hear myself all the time. I don't often consider that getting a meeting when I go out and I get to share. But thank you, you know, for getting up here and sharing your experience, strength, and hope. And I want to congratulate the birthday people, you know, for letting us, showing us, and demonstrating us that this program really works. And I'm through with that part of the deal. You know, Bob and I were riding over here, and, you know, I know how Bob does things. I know how a lot of people in this group, you know, I know about the recovery that's here. I know about what this group stands for. And, you know, I sit in the seat. You know, somebody out there, let me go on a tangent right now for a minute, because somebody out there, wake up, you know, is thinking to themselves, you know, I can't wait till the day that I stand up in front of the group and they hear my story. You know, they got this lame guy standing up here. You know I could do better than that. And, you know, and you're rehearsing the story. I remember being new, and after I wasn't so super new, when I was just somewhat new, and I couldn't hear the speaker because I was so busy thinking about what I'd be saying if I was speaking, right? You know, and sometimes I sit in the seat and I talk to a lot of people, and I think about the things I want to leave you with and how I want you to remember me and how I want, you know. I was at a spot this last weekend, and a chick stepped to me, and she came up to me and she says, "How do you get to be a circuit speaker?" Like, I'm like, "What is that about?" You know, she's like, I'm like, "Well, if I were you, I probably wouldn't worry about that. I like to worry about staying sober one day." Well, I'm already struck with that. I'm already stuck in that. I want to know how to go out and go around places and people listen to me. And somebody, if you're new to the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous and you're looking at the speakers when they roll up through here and you're thinking to yourself and you judging what you think recovery is based on what they share from this podium, get over it. You know, I'm talking about recovery. Recovery is a living process, and it's within the grasp, and it's within the reach of anybody sitting in this room right now. What we're going to do tonight is I'm going to talk a little bit about recovery, but don't trip off that. You can live this thing, because this is a living program. You know, I grew up in South Central Los Angeles long time ago, you know, and I came from an alcoholic. My father was an alcoholic, and my earliest memory of him was I didn't want to be like him. I identified with Denise's story when she said that she didn't want to be an alcoholic because it ran in her family, and she didn't like the way people performed. I didn't like the way my old man performed under the influence of alcohol either. Now, he wasn't violent, and he wasn't abusive. My father was an absentee drunk, and every other Friday, like clockwork, you could count on him not showing up with the check. Be a little kid in the neighborhood, feel like it was his duty to tell my family how my old man had been performing up at the pool hall the previous Friday or Saturday night, right? And I feel ashamed and embarrassed, and those are feelings I'm familiar with from an early age. I'm going to give you the abridged version because my brother was out here a couple of weeks ago, so you guys have a little snapshot, those of you who were here, and, you know, and I don't want to be redundant, but, you know, I come from a big family. It was six of us, and we stayed in a little two-bedroom apartment. Moms and pops stayed in one room, and the six boys stayed in three bunk beds in the other room. Now, it's a trip. Two people observing the same event see it totally differently. You know, now I wasn't here when Ronnie shared, but I've heard him share a lot of times, and his ideas and his views of us growing up a lot of ways are identical with mine, and in a lot of ways are totally dissimilar from mine. You know, and I grew up, and I come from a large family. Pops got put out when I was 9 or 10 years old, and you know, me and my brothers thought he looked good going. And my mother proceeded to raise six boys by herself. Now, my mother's a real strong sister, and she was on welfare at that time. And my mother, you know, got off welfare. She put herself back through high school. She put herself through college. She took in jobs from other folk. She worked two jobs, took in clothes from other folk. You know, and when you grown, you look back on your life and say, damn, look at what kind of mama I had. Look how she sacrificed to raise her boys. But when you're a kid about 9 or 10 years old and you're bringing a couple of partners home from school on a Wednesday afternoon and you hit the living room and mom's in the living room with ironing board up and a rag on her head, you don't feel proud. You feel ashamed and embarrassed. And if your name is Ralph, you start retreating into that fantasy world I've lived in much of my life. And it's the biggest prison I've ever lived in. It's the prison I live in sometimes today. And that's the prison of what I think you think about me. See, I don't know what you think about me, but I'm trapped in what I think you think about me. And I'll do whatever it takes to shape and form and mold your opinion around. I'll wine you, I'll dine you, I'll woo you, I'll con you, I'll bully you, I'll manipulate you, I'll buy you. Please like me. Now, I don't particularly have to like you, but please like me, you know. And so I'm growing up like this, man, and I got this strong mother. And you heard my brother, and a lot of my story revolves around my mom. You know, I did a lot of things. I achieved a couple of things, and I accomplished a couple of things in life. And very little of that is due to any virtue on my part. Much of it is due to fear of my mama. You know, I'm the second oldest, and I got an older brother. He's 4 years older than me, lives in Boston, Massachusetts. He's not in this program, but, you know, I remember being at school one day. I was in the third of grade, and he was in the sixth. And a little girl came to my classroom and said, your mother's up at the school today. That wasn't totally strange because my mom did all those other things I told you, worked two jobs, took in clothes, she washed and ironed, and she was also PTA president most years. So she was at the school a lot. But this was strange. It was in the middle of the day on about a Wednesday or Thursday. And she proceeded to say, you know, because my brother was the problem child, my older brother. And they used to call home, and my mother finally said, don't call later. Next time you get into something, call me right then. Well, he had got into something, and they called, and the little girl proceeded to say, ooh, your mama's up at the school, and she gave your brother a whooping right in front of the whole class. She didn't have to worry about nobody else. I'm not going out like that. I'm not going to get whooped. So I was a model citizen in school. I was a straight-A student. I was teacher's pet. You know, I was class president. You know, I played ball, made all-stars. On the inside, I felt like, you know, on the outside, it seemed like I should have been okay. On the inside, I've always felt like if you really knew me, you wouldn't like me. You know, to our new friends in Alcoholics Anonymous, you'll hear a lot of stories at the podium. And one of the common themes from our members is never feeling like they fit in. And that's not a part of my story. I'm a little guy. I like a lot of attention. I've never really been interested in fitting in. I've always wanted to stand out. And as a result of that, I achieved and I accomplished a lot growing up. You know, all of you guys saw me in your class. You know, and there are as many portraits of the alcoholic as there are people sitting in this room right now. You know, don't get confused with what's a real alcoholic anyway. And that, when I was new, I used to get stuck on that. You know, because I wasn't like my old man. I wasn't at the pool hall. I wasn't hanging out, you know. I thought I was cool. I was from a different era. I ran with a slick crew. You know, we thought we had some things going on. I accomplished some things. My old man was a janitor. You know, I was, you know, later on in life, I was a college graduate. You know, I was on a fast track for success. So I didn't identify myself with the same way. Same as a lot of you in here may not. You know, and I'm not alcoholic because I come from a broken home. I'm not alcoholic because I'm a black dude from South Central Los Angeles. Look around this room. You know, look around the room. And most of y'all ain't from South Central Los Angeles. You know, I'm not alcoholic because I didn't grow up with a lot of money. There's some people sitting in here right now that grew up with a silver spoon. I'm not alcoholic, you know, because like I said, I'm from a groping home. There's people in here that have both parents. I'm not alcoholic because I'm a short guy. There's some big, tall guys in here. I'm not alcoholic because I'm a man. We got plenty of women in here. I'm an alcoholic for two reasons alone. I'm bodily and mentally different from other folk. That's it. That's all. The rest is my story. And since I'm the speaker tonight, that's the story you're going to get, you know. You know, so I'm growing up and I'm going through life. And when Ronnie shares his story, you know, it's kind of bleak. And we didn't have a lot of money when I grew up. I wouldn't have traded my life growing up for anybody I know. Wouldn't have traded it. See, you don't know what you don't have till you run into, till you have something. And then you realize, oh, I didn't trip off the fact we didn't have a car in my family. First car we ever had in my family was the car I bought when I graduated from high school. I didn't trip off that. We got around. Me and my brothers caught the bus. We did everything we needed to do, you know, neighbors, uncle, whatever. You know, I didn't trip. You know, I never knew a lonely moment. It was six of us. We played board games. We created games. We played baseball in the house. We played pickle. We played overline. We played basketball. We played football. We played catch. We played three flies up. We always had something to do, man. Back in those days, kids played in neighborhoods, and you went to parks. I feel sorry for kids. So, you know, my story, and when I hear Ronnie's story, some of it is, oh, what's that? I used to go to sleep on Christmas Eve in all my clothes because I couldn't wait to get up. Little that I didn't know then how my mama struggled and how, you know, the budget for Christmas for six boys was probably $30 or $60. But I enjoyed those Chinese checkers and the Monopoly game. You know, I enjoyed those things. You know, when I go out now and I got a little one, you know, but anyway, you know, my point is, don't let the portrait I'm painting make you think, oh, this guy grew up in this. No. Moms cooked it every holiday. We had a lot of people over to the house all the time. My mother ran this household. My mom's a strong mom. So I grew up for me, in a background I wouldn't have changed. I was spoiled in some ways. I always had birthday parties. Like I told you, I was always class president, student body president. So I grew up like this, man. And so, you know, I'm growing up and I'm kind of just going through life, right? And I'm painting the picture. This is how I grew up. Not going to be like my dad. I'll never embarrass my family. I'll never abandon my family. I'll make my kids proud of me, whoever they are, one day I get them. You know, and I was a shy guy. You know, I was smart, and yeah, I was teacher's pet, and yeah, I was straight-A student, but I would have traded it in to be cool because the cats in my neighborhood who was cool, it wasn't a big currency on smart, but it was a big currency put on cool where I grew up. And the cats who was cool was shooting dice in the bathroom, smoking cigarettes, and they knew how to talk to girls, and girls were a mystery to me, man. You know, I didn't know how to talk to girls, and so I'm growing up, let's fast forward this. I'm in high school now. I get a girlfriend. I'm 16 years old. Now, Ralph with a girlfriend at 16 don't mean the same thing it means for some of you guys. Ralph with a girlfriend at 16 simply means this. I ran with a crew of dudes that went with the same group of girls. One of my boys broke up with this girl. I waited a suitable amount of time to pass, and I told my other boy, look, I want to go with her. He went and asked her, came back and told me, she said, yes, now I have a girlfriend, right? I don't know what to do because Ralph don't do girls, you know. This is a true story. This is my for real girlfriend. I had other girlfriends before, but this one actually knew she was my girlfriend, right? You know. If you ask her, who do you go with, she would have told you, I go with, you know. And in those days, man, I would call her on the phone, those old rotary phones, and that seventh number, some of y'all don't know what I'm talking about, but, you know, the ones who do, y'all know. You know, the old black rotary phones, the ones that, you know, that you couldn't carry around the house. They didn't go no further than the cord. Some of these youngsters in here are like, what is he talking about, you know. But anyway, that seventh number would go around, and it'll come back, and terror would set in. Because I knew what would have to happen when she answered the phone. You got to talk. It's the telephone, right? And I didn't have no conversation, so I'd hang up on my girlfriend. Click, right? This particular night, I go out on a double date. Me and my boy, you know, my boy is driving. He's a little older than me. Him and his girl are in the front seat. Me and my girl are in the back seat. Plastic cup of rum and coke comes to the back seat this particular night. I drank it down, went down real warm. All of a sudden, rushed back to the top of my brain, and all of a sudden, Ralph's hands started doing things they had never done. Mouth started saying things it had never said, and I had arrived. Alcohol did for me what I couldn't do for myself. Gave me the courage to do and to be and to say things I wouldn't do, be, and say without it. And I liked it. I liked it a lot. The big book Alcoholics Anonymous talks about me in a lot of places. We had a lot of new friends stand up, and a lot of times we just talk from the podium and assume people know, you know, but maybe you do, but sometimes I remind myself, you know, there's a chapter in our book at the front called A Doctor's Opinion. And in The Doctor's Opinion, there's a line in there that goes something like this. Men and women like Ralph drink essentially for the effect produced by alcohol. I recognized that line the first time I saw it. Now, if you caught me later on in life at the happy hour or something, drinking them sweet drinks, and you asked me why you drinking so much, I like to tell you, hell, if I was drinking for taste, I could have stuck with Minute Maid Fruit Punch. I like the taste of that. I like what alcohol did for me. I'm not overnight alcoholic. I understand when we talk about this disease being progressive in nature, because that's the way it showed up in my experience. I drank that night. I got a tipsy feeling. It was real warm. I had fun. I like what it did. That's how my drinking stayed for a long time. I would drink to go out on parties and have a good time, and it stayed that way for a while. I graduated from high school in 71, and I graduated to higher education in every sense of the word. 71, I'm still drinking to go to parties, but by the end of 71, I'm drinking not only to go to parties, but now I'm drinking to get ready for the party. By 72, I'm drinking not only on the weekends, but I'm drinking after class during the week. By the middle of 72, I'm drinking. Now I'm drinking on the weekends. I'm drinking on the week during the week, and I've added some non-addictive marijuana to the mix. By the end of 72, I'm drinking, I'm smoking herb, and I'm selling herb. By 73, I'm drinking, I'm smoking herb, I'm selling herb, I'm doing other drugs, I'm doing it on a daily basis, and you could not have told me it was anything wrong with the way that I was living. The Big Book Alcoholics Anonymous talks about at a certain point in my drinking career, I won't be able to tell the truth from the false. And the way that that worked for me was this. Isn't the way that I'm doing it, isn't that the way everybody does it? Why would you be young, with a bright future, with a little bit of money? I was getting financial aid. Didn't chasing women and getting loaded come with the territory? In those days, man, if you came over my house and I couldn't offer you something to drink or something to smoke, I wasn't being a good host. And if I went over your house and you didn't do the same for me, not only weren't you being a good host, wasn't coming over your house no more. You know. For what? You know, we didn't have nothing to talk about. You know, I described a little bit about when I grew up and the era I came up in, and I'm glad I grew up in that era. I really, 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 no disrespect to our young friends. I'm not talking about new friends, young friends. But I'm glad I grew up at the time that I grew up. I don't know if it was a simpler time, but it seemed like it was a simpler time. You know, in 2006, you got to worry about sexually transmitted diseases and safe sex. And, hey, man, back in those days, I would go to a club. I'd have a one-question interview for a girl. You get high? If not, next, I don't need to know your sign or your last name or where you work or who your mom. Let's get to the basis of this relationship. Do you drink the way that I do? You know, and that's the way that I was rolling. You know, somehow I made it through school and I started working at a job for L.A. City Schools that should have allowed me to acquire what normal people did. I never did that. Snapshot of Ralph's life. This is when alcohol was working. I would go to work. You know, work and make some money. I'd buy a car and I'd make exactly 3 car payments. Exactly 3. Then come find it. First time I had a car repossessed, I had the nerve to call the police. You know, they had been sending me notices for 9 months. And I'm 9 months late. Got the nerve to call the police. My car is, no, and they did whatever they do. No, Mr. Wright, the rightful owner just came and picked up this. You know, the next 2 times I was already experienced at this, you know. But that's how I was rolling, man. I'm the kind of brother never had a problem balancing a bank book. Payday, I got money. 2 days later, broke. 0. No problem balancing my bank book. You know, I stayed in the crib from 76 to 79 without paying rent. A couple of baffling features about the disease I suffer from, and one of them is this. I can't see my relationship with alcohol until I'm free of it. I can't see what it's doing to me when I'm in the mix. So some of the things that I'm sharing tonight that are crystal clear to me in the rearview mirror of experience were not at all clear to me when I was going through them. You know, the thing I don't... alcohol is a... I used to go to a jazz festival every year. You know, Berkeley had a jazz festival. I was at a school, a sister school, and we used to go up to Berkeley every year for the jazz festival. This one year we went up there, and I do what I do. We get well fortified, and it's about 4 guys to a ride car, and we caravan. And we go up there this year, man, I'm toe up. I done passed out on Friday. We get up there, and I just lay in my partner's house Friday night. Saturday, we get up, and we start over again, do the same thing. Make it to the concert Saturday. Big mistake. I sit there, and about halfway through, I throw up over the whole row of people in front of me, you know, and I'm out. You know, then Sunday, we get back on the road to come home. I'm laid out in the car coming back home. Monday morning, I get to school, and I tell everybody, man, y'all missed a hell of a concert. You should have been, you know, an alcohol or wear that ass out and make you swear you partying. You know, and that is what happened to me over and over and over again. You know, we don't have enough time, and I ain't going to be here all night telling you guys about all the things that should have allowed me to see that maybe this alcohol thing is going to be a problem in your life. But some stuff stand out to me. I got married in 1980 on a Saturday afternoon. I had a bachelor party the Friday night before my wedding. None of the guys in my bachelor party are getting married the next day. All of them have sense enough to go home at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning. I'm still in my bachelor party till 7:30 in the morning, right? Me and my brothers. Take me home at 7:30, pour me in the bed, get me up at 10 o'clock for my 1 o'clock wedding. I'm toe up. I'm toe up, right? I just laid on top of the covers, man. You know that head throbbing, stomach going, throwing up stomach line, and that whole thing you got working, right? So I'm laying there, and I get up to go to my wedding, and I wobble in there, and I'm supposed to say my own vows. And my then wife-to-be took one look at me wobbling in there. She looked at the preacher. She said, scratch the own vows. Say the regular on him, right? So now my lines are cut to two words, and I get there, and it gets to me. I get ready to say, I threw up all over the altar. Passed out. Have not taken a wedding picture to this day. Pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. To our new friends, if you're anything like me when I first came to Alcoholics Anonymous, although I understood most of what you guys were talking about, the words that you guys were using were not the same way that I would use those words in my everyday walk around vocabulary. You guys were talking about this psychic change and this phenomenon of craving and this allergy of the body. And I needed some of the old timers around here to help me with some of that. But the first time I heard pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization, I need no help with that one. Folk like us don't need a dictionary for pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization. I lived pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization up close and personal, and I lived it over and over and over and over again. Because I got to let you guys know that that wedding day was the high point of that marriage. Went downhill after that. Because I'm the kind of father and I'm the kind of husband, remember sitting on my living room couch. Wife coming out the bathroom, pulling her pants up real fast. Going to the dining room table, picking her purse up off the table and clutching it real close to her as she went back to the bathroom. And I feel this tall because nobody was in the house but me and her, but it got like that in my house. I'm the kind of father and I'm the kind of husband, remember coming home and sticking the key in the door. Opening the door. My wife and my two-year-old daughter sitting right there, and they're crying. I look over here, and homeboy sitting in my seat with a gun pointed at my stomach talking about I want my money right now. And I don't know about the rest of you fellas, but I had a lot of fears and a lot of doubts about, do I have what it takes to be a husband? Do I have what it takes to be a father? Because if you're in the life, your track record already give you your answer, right? Because what's the father's role and what's the husband's role? To protect and to provide. And it's a cold-blooded feeling, fellas. Laying in bed with a woman night after night after night after night. Knowing not only aren't you protecting, knowing not only aren't you providing, you the one bringing the wolf to the door. See, my house got broke into several times. Each time I pretended to call 77th Division Police Station. Each time I knew I was playing a game with myself because I knew what was up there told me, you're going to give us our money or we're going to come up in there and get it. I'm the kind of father and I'm the kind of husband, remember sitting on my back porch. Two-year-old daughter coming outside, pulling at my coat. Daddy, daddy, that's my piggy bank. I remember stopping and giving her a little grin. Don't worry, baby. Daddy's going to put some dollar bills in here for this change. And I wasn't raised to be stealing from my daughter. And I wasn't raised to be stealing from my wife. But I was an alcoholic with no tools of recovery, and I did what it took to get what I needed to get. I've already shared with you guys that my disease is progressive in nature, and in my experience, it's progressive in a couple of areas. Share one area already. It takes more than it used to take in order for me to get the same effect. But my disease is progressive in another area, my behavior. My behavior gets progressively worse. I'm willing to do more readily than I used to be willing to do to chase this thing. First time I went in my wife's purse, if you had strapped me to a polygraph, I would have passed when I told you I wasn't stealing the money. Took $40 out and I said, I got to replace this money before she knows it's missing. And I meant it. And I meant it. I don't steal. Took that 40 out, went out and spent it up, came back looking for some more money. She had moved a purse. I didn't look too hard because I couldn't believe I had taken this money out. And I said to myself, I'm going to replace that money before she knows it's missing. Big Book Alcoholics Anonymous was written, published back in 1939, saw me coming in 1986. does a lot of talking about me in that book. One of the places it talks about me and said, we don't know why, but an alcoholic could be unable to recall with sufficient force pain, suffering, humiliation, or weeks or even days ago. And that vow I made to replace that money before she knew it was missing, same scenario presented 2 weeks later. Got paid, gave her some money, went out, do what I do. End of the night, I come in looking for some more money. She wasn't hiding the purse yet because she wasn't used to me hitting it, so I found the person. I didn't deliberate so long this time. And that idea about replacing the money didn't come to mind. In fact, it got replaced by a new idea. I said, last time I took $40 out, came back looking for some more money. This time I'll take all the money out, and that I don't spend up, I'll sneak it back in the purse, right? And I was off and running to hit my wife's purse. She would sleep with it up under the pillow. Something about laying in bed with that feeling on you when you've been out. Something about laying in bed knowing money's just an arm's length away. And I'd be laying there, and I'd wait for that real regular breathing to set in, and I'd let it set in for a minute. I'd crawl out my side of the bed, and I'd crawl over to hers, and I'd come up under that pillow, and I'd come out real slow, put the purse in front of me, creep out the bedroom, creep out the living room, jump in my car, coast out the driveway, I'm gone. It's Wednesday. I come back Monday. Did that one too many Mondays, came back. One Wednesday in, a note was on the screen door. The rest of your stuff is at your mom's house. Suitcase on the porch. I'm put out my house. I'm now my daddy. Went to stay at my mom's house, and over the course of that next year, all five of my brothers got put out their respective homes, and we all ended up at my mom's house. You know, over that period of time, a real, real, real bleak period. Bill talked about a bleak period when he sat around drinking. You know, and I tried this program 4 times before I came here to stay. And the way that I used to do it, somebody take me back to getting put out and staying in my mama's house if I get lost while I'm on this tangent. You know, the way that I used to do it the first times I came around the program is I'm a good mimic and I'm a good chameleon. I go to a meeting, I listen to a speaker share, I pick out some of the best things he said, I go to a meeting the next night, make sure he's not there, not too many of you guys, I repeat what he said, I tack on and keep coming back, and the program works, and I thought because I claimed it from the podium that would make it true in my experience, and I kept on drinking, and I kept on drinking, and I kept on drinking. I couldn't find myself anywhere in the big book Alcoholics Anonymous. I went to recovery home and I started reading the big book in my room. And since you guys read a portion of chapter 5 at the meetings, I knew that was the most important chapter. So I started reading the big book at chapter 5. Someone told me later on, Ralph, opening the big book Alcoholics Anonymous and starting at chapter 5 is like opening up a math book and starting on the chapter on algebra. You would look good to know some addition and subtraction first. Go to the beginning of that book. But that's just how I was doing it, man. And I would go in, and I couldn't see any similarities. I'd hear people sharing, and I liked the stories, and they were interesting. Didn't have nothing to do with me. I'd read that book, and I couldn't see Bill. I read Bill's story. We don't have anything in common. Bill's an older white gentleman. Look at me. We don't have that in common. You know, Bill was a veteran of foreign wars. I'm a Vietnam-era draft dodger. You know, Bill was a Wall Street stockbroker. Check out the way I handle money. A lot of differences in our story. You know, and then people started sharing with me the way to read the big book Alcoholics Anonymous. Somebody shared with me the way to read the big book Alcoholics Anonymous. And they said, Ralph, the same way that you read the big book Alcoholics Anonymous is the same way that you listen to our members share their stories from the podium. Ask yourself 3 or 4 questions when you read the book and when you listen to our members share. Ask yourself, did I drink like he drank? Did I think like he thought? Did I feel like he felt? Or did I do what he did? And when I started asking myself those questions, the book came alive for me. You know, I had 2 goals when I was a kid. One goal was to wear number 30 and play shortstop for the Dodgers. Maury Wills was the shortstop for the Dodgers. He was my idol. Baseball was my game. My second goal, and I meant it with everything in me, was to be the first black president of the United States. Big goals, grandiose. When I read Bill's story, did I think like he thought? Bill said he imagined himself the head of vast enterprises. I identify with that grandiosity. I proved to the world I was important. I identify with that. Later on in Bill's story, and I share about it now, when I think of my mom walking in the house with these six grown-ass leeches that were living in her house. You know, my mom would come in the house every single day with a bag of groceries, because if she didn't, you know, it wouldn't be anything in there, you know. And I could remember my mom, and when I read Bill's story and I thought of Bill laying up on the couch and Lois coming in every single day from the department store, every single day with a bag, reminded me so much of that. Did I do what he did? Did I think like he thought? Did I feel like he felt? And so at this period of time, man, it was really a bleak time. And, you know, and I had come from having some things, you know. I ended up, I was working at a company, a major utility in Los Angeles. I was working in management in their law department. I was on suspension for 90 days because something about, we got paid on Thursdays. I thought that was just stupid. I had to be in about my third inventory before I got over that one. I thought it was the stupidest thing. Who would pay people on Thursday? Anybody know you don't pay people on Thursday? I could never make it to work after Friday after Thursday payday. And I resented that for a long time. Anyway, you know, so at this period of time, man, it was something my ex-wife thought it was something salvageable about this piece of man that she married back at this period of time. And she used to bring my daughter over to my mom's house on Saturday so we could keep a father-daughter relationship. And I wanted to be a father to my little girl with everything in me. I really, 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 really did. I wanted to take my little girl to Disneyland and Magic Mountain. I wanted to take her to a movie on a Saturday afternoon. I wanted to read her stories and sit her in my lap. I wanted to take her up the street to the store with her little hand in my big hand and just buy her ice cream. I wanted to tuck her in bed at night and give her a good night kiss. I wanted to get the look from my little girl that I've seen men in this fellowship get since I've been here, to look like this is my daddy and this is my hero. And the best I could do on those Saturday afternoons was 30 minutes. 30 minutes. Tell my mom something like, I'm going to the store to get Rain some ice cream. And I go to the store and I disappear. I come back on Monday. I sneak back Sunday night when her mom was picking her up. And I could remember some of them long Sunday nights, man. I'd be sticking my head around the side of my mom's house. As those headlights were backing out and I'd see those two heads sitting in the car, I'd be thinking to myself, there go my life backing out this driveway. I'd be crying. Crying. And I've heard a lot of people share they were scared of dying out there. That ain't my story. I was never scared of dying. I was scared I was going to keep waking up to the same old thing. Monday the same as Tuesday, the same as Sunday, the same as Christmas, over and over and over again. And I am so glad that God don't make misery comfortable. And on October the 11th, 1986, I got miserable enough and I got tired enough that I got directed to my fourth program of recovery. And I went to the Harbor Light Center on Skid Row in downtown Los Angeles. My younger brother, Ron, was in there already. And I went up in there in that program, man, on October the 13th. And they took me to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous that Saturday. And a speaker was standing up in front of the room, somewhat like I am tonight. And I remember when I went to that meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, I was full of remorse. I was full of guilt. I was full of I'll never be able to forgive myself for the things I had done. I've only shared with you guys the tip of the iceberg. Didn't share when I went to stay at my mom's house, I started stealing out my mom's purse. Didn't share when I went to stay at my mom's house, a check came to one of my little brothers in the name of R. White. All of us are R. White. Took that. Didn't share with you when my grandmother gave me $200 to buy a plane ticket to the family reunion. If it wasn't for my mom, my grandmother never would have saw Atlanta, Georgia. Didn't share with you the first time I tried to get sober. My ex-wife got me a job at her job. Stole $1,600 from them. Ruined her reputation in the industry. Didn't share with you a lot. Suffice it to say I had a lot on my tip when I came. And I was full. I'll never be able to forgive myself for the things I'd done. And a speaker was standing up in front of the group, someone like I am tonight. And he was sharing about taking from the family. And he was sharing about taking from the job. And I remember sitting out there and looking at him and thinking to myself, yeah, you sharing about doing scandalous things, but you look scandalous. You should be doing this. You should have been doing that too. I'm different. Y'all ain't gonna hear my business. And the speaker seemed like he knew I was in the room and was reading my mail. He dropped something on me like this. He said, if you're sitting in this room right now, you are not responsible for your disease, but you are responsible for your recovery. And you have just now tapped into a source of power much greater than yourself. And you don't have to drink and you don't have to use no matter what, provided you are willing to fulfill some conditions. He caught my attention. He went on to say, this this is the only club you can be a member of where the worse off you are when you get here, the better off your chances of staying. And I got the message of hope at that first meeting, Alcoholics Anonymous, I went to. That speaker described to me what I suffer from, that it's something physically different about me than it is about other folk. And seemed like, and I know it wasn't true, but seemed like I took it personal, and seemed like he invited me to diagnose myself. Ralph, don't take my word for it. Ask yourself, how many times did you say, just ask yourself, how many times did you say, I'm just going to spend 20? What happened? Whole paycheck. How many times did you say, I'm just going to stop over here at happy hour? What happened? Whole paycheck. How many times did you say, I'm going to just stop over here at my boy's house for one? What happened? Whole paycheck. Ralph, did it happen once? Did it happen twice? If your name is Ralph, every 2 weeks, like clockwork, from 1979, 1986. Whole paycheck. My experience, not yours, not yours, not yours, not Bill Wilson's, not Dr. Bob, not none of the first 100. My experience abundantly shows me when I take one of anything, no matter what I have to do, where I have to go, who I have to see, no matter how great the wish or the necessity, my body takes over and I have to have another. Okay. If it's just my body, Ralph, how do you explain stone sober? My car seemed to drive to the LIQ on payday, second part of this disease. The mental obsession, the obsession that somehow, someday, I'll be able to control and enjoy this magic potion I discovered. Call one to be in if your name is Ralph. How the hell do I get to control and enjoy? Anytime I was controlling, I wasn't enjoying. And anytime I was enjoying, I damn sure wasn't controlling. Why am I stuck on that? I can't drink because of my body. I can't stop because my mind refuses to accept that fact. I'm powerless. Third part of this disease, spiritual malady. 12 and 12 calls it a soul sickness. In the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, it says, Ralph, if you work on the spiritual, the mental and the physical are straightened out. That's what we do in these rooms. New friends. We had a lot of new friends. The rest of you guys can leave right now. I just want to talk to a few people. You might get something if you stay. I want to talk to our new friends. I want to talk to the people that I see all stand up in this room tonight. You know, to our new friends, if you're sitting in here and you're wondering what this means and what this means and what these people are talking about at the podium and what the hell is a program of recovery. I'm coming out of this thing. Man, what this thing really is? Bill Wilson describes it in a lot of places, and he calls it a manner of living. A manner of living. We on a new road. What it is that I walked into October 11, 1986 was a new way of life, was a new way of living. And if you come from the places I come from a real dark place. I come from a real bleak place. I'm one of the ones that had to go all the way to the bottom. I'm one of the ones that had to go to the end of the line. I'm one of the ones when they talk about the last house on the block, I'm one of them. That's my story. I'm one of the ones that had a lot of things. And if you be alcoholic, that means you have a lot of things to lose, and I lost each and every one of them. In October 1986, man, I was so far down the thought of getting up didn't come to mind no more. You know, before I came to this program, I was sitting in, I could remember, it had been so long since I'd answered anybody's 8 o'clock or 9 o'clock wake up call to go to work. I didn't know if I was employable, didn't even know if I ever wanted to go to work anymore. You know, if you're sitting in this room right now and you're looking for a speaker, see, I'm not the speaker that's trying to scare you into recovery. If you're looking for one that's, if you go back out there, it's still kicking it. If you do this, that ain't me. I told you guys I did some of everything when I was out there. And at what I thought was my height, sometimes people used to look at me and be like, damn, Ralph, ain't you scared of overdose? I'd be like, scared of overdose? I'm scared of the deadly underdose. You better put some more shit. You know, so the message that a whole lot, you know. The message that a whole alcoholic of my variety, the big book talks about, it's not the message of fear. The book talks about a message that's got to have depth and that's got to have weight. And the message that tonight's speaker had to bring to you guys that's got the most depth and the most weight is that you're looking at a guy who at 33 years old had given up on life. You're looking at a guy who at 33 years old did not know where his little girl lived and didn't know what school she was enrolled in. You're looking at a guy who at 33 years old didn't know if he would ever be employable again. You're looking at a guy who graduated from a major university in this country. And my job at the end of my drinking was taking the trash out for a 21-year-old. I was sleeping in the back of my mother's garage, and I was eating lemons off a neighbor's lemon tree for breakfast. And I stumbled into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I met the men and women in here, the fellowship I crave. And the men and women in this fellowship, they nursed me and they loved me back to health. Said something I found real funny back in those days. They said, Ralph, let us love you till you can love yourself. You lying, and I know it. How you gonna tell me you'll love me? It had been, in the last 4 years of my drinking, I never looked at myself full face in a mirror, never. I took glances and I looked sideways. Couldn't stand what I had become. How you gonna tell me you'll love me? If you turn your back on me, I'm liable to go up in your purse right now. How you gonna tell me you'll love me? I stink. gonna tell me you'll love me? That was before I knew what takes place in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. That was before I knew what happens when the God in you reaches out to the God in me. That was before I knew that in Alcoholics Anonymous, we specialize in loving unlovable people. And you love me and you nurse me back to health. You gave me a program of recovery, a way out upon which we can all agree. And you gave me some 12 steps. And I'm one of the ones who talks a lot about the program of recovery. I talk a lot about the steps. I talk a lot about the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous. I talk a lot about my fellowship. I talk, but more than all the talking, I try to live this to the best of my ability. And I don't do it because I'm virtuous, and I don't do it because it's chic to be sober in 2006. I do it because I'm desperate. I do it because I'm hungry. I do it for my life, and now I do it because I want to. And I don't know when that transition came. There was a time I used to say, if I could do it and have no consequences, I'd still be doing it. You know, and there's a point in the book where it talks about seemingly he wouldn't take a drink even if he could. And I don't know when that happened for me. As in most things that happen in this program, new friends, it's a looking back experience. It's a looking back experience. Don't spend all those first 30 days looking at, damn, when am I going to get to where he is? Oh man, when am I going to get? It's a looking back experience. Most of the time, folks saw it in me before I saw it. It's like going to the gym. If you sit up and go to the gym and want to look at yourself in the mirror every day, you're going to get discouraged and you're going to stop going. Because when you go to the gym, what happens first? You ain't exercised some muscle, so you sore and you hurting and you real discouraged, because when you were a youngster, you could do 50 pull-ups and you go in the gym now and you're doing 10 and you can't even make it up on the 10th one. So you're like, damn, new friend. If you're going in there measuring against what somebody else is doing, but don't go in there, it's a looking back experience. I can never see the value of the lesson when I'm in the classroom, stay in the classroom, and I get the value of it. When I came in here, man, I started going to meet. I was too scared, and I was so afraid of rejection when I came to the program of recovery that you guys talked about getting a sponsor. And I went to a meeting one night, and I'm sitting in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm feeling alone in Alcoholics Anonymous, like one of our new friends might be tonight. I'm feeling alone in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Everybody knew everybody. At the break, they all talked to each other. They seemed happy. Wasn't nothing funny to me. They were smiling. I didn't have nothing to smile about yet. People had things. I didn't have anything. But I didn't want what I did have. I had done the first parts of the step. See, there are some steps that precede the affirmative steps. I had done the negative steps. I had come to believe in the hopelessness and futility of life as I had been living it. You ain't got to believe in nothing that we're doing up in here yet. But do you believe if you keep doing what you're doing, you're going to keep getting what you're getting? That's how I came in here. I came in here off believing in the hopelessness and futility, and I was tired of that. I didn't know what recovery had waiting on me. I didn't know that. But I knew what the life had waiting on me, and I was tired. So I came in here. I'm going to give you guys a shout out of desperation. I'm going to give you guys a shout out of what do I have to lose, the essence of the step two experience. Step one is the problem. Admitted that I'm powerless and my life is becoming a man. You know, when you do step one, a lot of people talk about doing the work on step. I don't know about doing the work on step. I did the work on step one when I was out there. Step one is a conclusion I draw based on my experience, but I need you guys to show me the truth about that experience. And then I listen to you and you and you and you and you and you say, alcohol wore me out and it ain't no comeback and it snuffed out the last flicker of hope I could do it by myself. And I was propelled into step two. And God damn, it's 8:30 already. And it's so time fly when you're having fun. But you know, I'm one of the people, you know, you guys know, I don't know where we're going to go when I get up here. But you know, the speaker, Denise, talked about being great. Grateful, and I'm still as grateful as the day I hit the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm grateful that you guys gave me a new way of life. I'm grateful that you guys gave me a way out of the dark hole I'm living in. I'm grateful that I'm a husband to my wife today, and we'll be celebrating 13 years in September. I'm grateful to have an 11-year-old daughter who's never seen her daddy loaded in one day at a time, never will. I'm grateful that my daughter, when she put me on the plane today, I never have, and I get on a lot of planes, and I do a lot of traveling, and I go a lot of places, and I've never yet seen in that little girl's the flicker of doubt, like, is daddy coming home? She don't know that guy. I'm grateful that on Father's Day in 2006, I was sitting in the audience at UCLA, and that 2-year-old daughter whose piggy bank I was going in, she tossed the tassel to the other side, and she came, and I took the pictures with my girls, and I get the look from my girls, like, this is my daddy, and this is my hero. I'm grateful that 2 years ago, these 6 boys that was leeching off my mama saw my mama walk through the door, and everybody hollered, hell, surprise, and my mother had a surprise 75th birthday. birthday party given by those six grown leeches. That's Alcoholics Anonymous. And I found out then, you know, I'm grateful. I'm still grateful. I'm as grateful as the day I came up in here. And you'd be grateful, too, if you knew what you were walking into. You'd be grateful, too, if you knew the life you were getting ready to embark on. You'd be grateful, too, if you knew exactly what it is we're doing right now. You'd be grateful, too, if you think about what it is that we get appointed to do. Can't nobody else do it. Somebody pull me down. I'm getting ready to get out. But you'd be grateful, too. You'd be grateful, too, to know what it is we're doing right now. It's people that's grateful that don't even know us. It's some little boys and some little girls that we don't even know and we ain't even seeing right now. That every time I go to a meeting, I get to participate in them getting ready to have mama come home. Every time I go to a meeting, I get to participate in some family getting ready to have daddy come back in the house. Every time I go to a meeting, I get to participate in some family being reunited. Every time I go to a meeting, I get to participate in some employer who I don't know and could care less about getting ready to have a hell of an employee come up in the workplace. Who wouldn't want to be part of a fellowship like that? I've always wanted to be important, and I've always wanted to leave my mark, and I can think of nothing more important and more significant than being a participating member of the life-saving, life-changing experience. That is Alcoholics Anonymous. I know exactly why I'm sober. You'll never hear me say I don't. I get a blessing so that I can be a blessing. Recovery for me is a gift from God. What I do with my recovery, that's my gift to God. My name is Ralph White, and I am an alcoholic.